All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking fast right now because we got a whole hell of a lot to talk with you about in the show today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Reverend Frank Wolf and Ramona Tolliver, and they're members of the Faith Task Force of Refuse Fascism. And before that, we'll be talking with Boots Riley, rapper, producer, screenwriter, and director. And he joins us to talk about his recently released debut film, Sorry to Bother You. All right? And that's I just really loved the film, and I enjoyed the conversation with Boots, so you'll be getting that. But opening the show up is somebody I met at Sundance when she was helping, or she was part of a film that had been made there about finding bodies in the desert and the quest to find out who those people were and get to their families. And her name is Robin Reinecke. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Calibri Center for Human Rights. And when we were talking back then, it was sort of something that really stuck in my mind. And I just recently read a piece that Robin had written, and it was about family separations and how it's forever and death and disappearance and the U.S. government's policies designed to inflict maximum suffering. And I'm just going to jump into it because I have so many things to ask you. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's good to talk with you again, Michael.
Yeah, you too. So let's jump into this. You've spent 11 years documenting immigrant deaths along the border, and you've described the situation as one of the more silent, invisible human rights catastrophes in the world. Give people a sense of what you're talking about there.
Thanks for that question. Yeah, I'm standing here right now in the courtyard of the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner in Tucson, Arizona. And it is mid-July. Going to get to be over 100 today. Thankfully, the monsoons have started. So the worst is over, but now it's humid. But this is the 12th year. The cicadas are quite loud. So if you hear that in the background, sorry. But the 12th summer that I've spent smelling the decomposed beds brought in from the desert every single day. And I wish I could translate to you all the feeling of watching that unfold. You know, we had a summer, one July, where it was two bodies a day. Watching the database click along and another record comes in for a young woman's remains found in southern Arizona, highly decomposed, a skull found by hikers, Border Patrol driving along and hearing a crunch and looking down and finding a human skull under the tire. Tohono O'odham people on the native land going outside in their backyard, and their dog has something strange in its mouth, and it's part of a human hand. This is what it's felt like here, being present in Tucson over the last more than a decade. And it's not just me, but hundreds of people who are involved in providing aid and trying to save people's lives, bandaging feet, putting out water, at this point in time now being increasingly deterred from doing that, and those humanitarian actions being criminalized. So what I mean when I say invisible and erased humanitarian human rights catastrophes, part of what I'm pointing to is just there's a shocking nature of seeing a dead body. At this point in my life, what's even more shocking is that we are seeing this many dead and we're still not talking about it as a nation. We're still not really concerned and having a national dialogue about the fact that in southern Arizona alone, an average of 175 bodies are found in and around where I live. So to me, that's the bigger crisis and the more shocking thing. It's not only the loss of life, but it's the fact that there doesn't seem to be outrage about it. So I'm hopeful that there's some outrage about family separation being perpetrated by the Trump administration right now. And I just really hope that we can translate that discussion into a broader conversation about human rights violations and violence along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a comment that you make in this article that you wrote where you're talking about your work trying to identify a young man from Guatemala, and you're using a video to help you do that. And it just really struck me. I mean, I had to read this like two or three times just to get the full, you know, just to comprehend the horror of this. You say that there's this picture of this smiling young guy, and your task was identifying his teeth. So you kept stopping the picture. You kept stopping the photo and looking. And so you could identify his teeth. So you might be able to identify his skull, who he was. I can't imagine the horror in that. And it really concentrates something about the inhumanity that is being concentrated there. And what's being said about the people there and their humanity.
Yeah, so that I'm standing now looking into the lunchroom at the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner, kind of an old county office, not that fancy. But I used to take lunch breaks every day with my mentor and my teacher, Dr. Bruce Anderson, the forensic anthropologist here. And there used to be a TV, a little, you know, old TV and a VHS player set up in the lunchroom. And his colleague loved to watch Judge Judy, so that would often be on at lunchtime. But we got a missing persons report. We got a call from a mother, Fermina, who was searching for her son, who was 14 years old, Nelson Omar, who she had left in Guatemala to try to keep him safe and at home. She migrated north to send money back so that he could have hopes of education, and she thought she could defend him and take care of him better with more financial resources. So she migrated to the U.S. Nelson had been missing her for a long time, but then his home situation became increasingly unsafe. So he decided to leave and head north from Guatemala to join his mom. An older neighbor, a woman about 50 years old, joined him on the journey. And they both disappeared together. So Fermina, Nelson's mom, called me. At the time, I was a volunteer learning under the forensic anthropologist here. And I took down information, and I hate asking this question, but I asked her, can you describe his teeth, or do you have any smiling photographs of him? And the reason that we have to ask that is because so many of the remains are so highly decomposed or skeletal that there's no hope of identifying them without either DNA or dental records. These people are so impoverished that I already knew that she probably wouldn't have dental records, but maybe she would have a photograph. She said, I don't have a good smiling photo, but Nelson did send me a VHS tape, like a greeting that they had recorded of Nelson smiling and saying hi to his mom so that she could see a video of him because they missed each other. She sent us that VHS tape. And Bruce and I went into the lunchroom, and we put that in the VHS player and sat there and fought back tears and tried to pause the tape when this little cute kid is smiling, because skeletal remains had been found together of an older woman in her 50s and a young boy probably under 15. And so we were finally able to positively identify those remains as those of Nelson's and this older woman that was trying to protect him. But it took 2 years until their remains were found in the desert.
Boy, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Robin Reinecke, and she's co-founder and executive director of the Colibri Center for Human Rights. And we're talking about family separation is forever, death and disappearance, and the U.S. government's policies designed to inflict maximum suffering. I'm telling you, Robin, I just really had to get up really early this morning because it got to a point where it was just too much to think about this thing in a certain sense, in terms of the descriptive way that you've put this stuff. And it's important that people understand this. And one of the things that you've spoken to is that how families are separated today through both detention and death and disappearance. And you say that both of these aren't like separate things. One's not better than the other, or one's not worse than the other. You say both of these are the results of policies that are specifically designed to inflict maximum suffering. Let's talk about that.
Right. So the Trump administration right now is increasing and doubling down upon and exacerbating in very extreme ways human rights abuses along the border. But we have to take a look at some of the underlying logic and the underlying strategies that predate Trump. So one of the biggest ones that we are aware of very painfully every day in southern Arizona is just a strategy called prevention through deterrence on the U.S.-Mexico border. So there was a 1994, so this is under the Clinton administration, policy document that was co-written between then INS, precursor to ICE, kind of, co-written with the Center for Low Intensity Conflict. And it was a 1994 Border Patrol strategic plan, and it outlined this strategy that they called prevention through deterrence. And that was basically a theory that the more deadly, the more risky, the more dangerous, the more expensive that an undocumented border crossing became, the idea was the fewer people would try to take it. So it's almost like a moat, like thinking of the U.S.-Mexico border as a moat or as a deadly zone to try to deter people from crossing that territory. In a few short years, it was already clear that that strategy of, you know, closing off the safe kind of places where people would try to jump under the fence or run across the highway, those areas became very heavily patrolled. And what was left open, well, more or less open, were the very remote and dangerous expanses of the desert. And in this policy document, it says we want to basically use the geography strategically, the searing heat of the desert geography of the Southwest, the searing heat. It said that people crossing that area would find themselves in mortal danger. Under assumptions, the plan listed violence will increase as effects of strategy are felt. So there were all of these assumptions that they were going to basically hinge human suffering, they were going to connect human suffering to the policies of border enforcement. People would be punished physically for trying to cross that border. So that's the whole kind of theory and strategy behind prevention through deterrence. And so fast forward 20 years and easily 10,000 deaths and no significant dip in overall migration along the border that can be correlated. And this is pretty statistically rigorously backed up in research. So the strategy did increase deaths. It didn't significantly or in any meaningful way decrease overall migration. And yet, here we are in 2018, and we're hearing the Trump administration, at least three officials have cited deterrence as trying to explain their strategy of why they're separating families. Kirsten Nelson mentioned deterrence. Sessions mentioned deterrence. Trump himself has mentioned deterrence, and others in the administration have mentioned deterrence. And to me, it's a really sick and violent idea because it's basically saying it's a dehumanizing theory that justifies inflicting harm on someone in the name of security, which I find like very, how can something be secure where there's thousands of deaths there every year? So I think we need to take a look at prevention through deterrence as a strategy. And, you know, it's very different what's happening on the border than, you know, people use the analogy of someone trying to break into their house. It's a very, very different context where you have, you know, 100-year or more history of people crossing across that border for work and being invited to do so. And then you've got a family separation issue. And then you've got people trying to flee violence, whether it's domestic violence or gang violence. So it's a real different context than personal security concerns.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, and you started to refer to this, but there's another way that this works too, which is actually when people are looking for their loved ones, whether they're still back in their home country, the people looking for them, or whether they're here, and they're trying, especially if they're here, they're trying to actually figure out, okay, what happened to my husband, to my sister, to my wife, to my daughter, my son, you know, because people disappear and for years no one's heard from and no one knows whether these people are alive or dead. And anytime there's a fear and a price to pay, it seems, if you step forward, and a lot of people think this way too, and righteously so, because they're familiar with what it means if these Nazis come up and grab you and you're done, you know. And so this whole sort of price you have to pay to even search for your loved one.
Right. It exposes people to a lot of risk when they start to search for their loved ones. And I can't overestimate how devastating it is to have your son disappear, or your father, or your sister. Time stops. In the short term, families struggle to eat and sleep, go to work, I mean, if you can just imagine how terrifying that would be, or if any of you are parents and you've lost track of your kid for even just 10 minutes at a park or something like that, it's pure terror. I mean, there's a reason why some violent dictatorships such as Argentina in the past enforced disappearance as a strategy of torture to suppress political action. It's incredibly psychologically and socially damaging. So these families are really suffering without information. And then on top of it, many of them are undocumented or themselves in economically or security-wise, you know, insecure situations in Central America or Southern Mexico. And so they're searching for their kid, and that search can kind of open them up to further abuses or to being, you know, a lot of the families that we talk to are extorted, or they're told, we have your daughter and we're going to kill her unless you wire us over $5,000. So the families are in a really horrible situation. And Colibri Center for Human Rights is one of a small handful of groups along the border trying to respond. And, you know, my personal political analysis is that this is state violence being perpetrated along the border. But whether or not you agree with me on that, I dearly hope that you can recognize the humanity of people to the extent that they should know what happened to their kid, regardless of what their kid was doing, that they should be able to know what happened. They should be able to bury their child, that those bones shouldn't just be left out in the desert forever, that they should be cared for like we would care for anyone among us as a human being. So Colibri works hard and diligently to do that, to bring answers to the families. And I will tell you right now, we are absolutely inundated. We're a staff of four. This is political work. It's hard to fund. We're a staff of four with a backlog of 700 people at this moment. That's 700 people who basically left us a voicemail and are waiting for us to call them back.
Boy. And we only have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to speak to this. I think it's very powerful what we've been talking about, and we'll have you back again to talk about it more and follow it as it goes along. The death toll over 20 years, because that's something that, you know, there's sort of the denial of people's humanity folds down into even just not reporting on what the actual death toll is in relation to this. So people have an idea of, we're not talking about a person here, a person there. We're talking about a mass phenomenon here.
Yeah. So that 700 number that I cited, that's the number of people, you know, just calling us right around now and waiting for us to record their details. We have an additional 3,000 names in our database of people who've disappeared. Most of those are relevant to Arizona because that's where we're really focused. But then, so those are people who are missing, where the mother or whatever is waiting for news about her son who disappeared crossing. And then on the other side is the dead. So in southern Arizona, we're approaching 3,000 dead over the past 20 years, so starting 18 years, starting in 2000. About 1,000 of those are unidentified human remains. And then if you add in Texas, thousands more. And we don't even know how many people have actually died crossing. We don't know how many people have been recovered, because the only agency releasing any kind of comprehensive count is Border Patrol. Mm-hmm. And CNN, you can look it up. CNN did a really good investigative deep dive into how problematic and incomplete those numbers are. Mm-hmm. So I think it kind of touches again on the first thing that we talked about, how erased this entire crisis is. We as a nation, we aren't even taking the first step to at least just count how many have been found.
Mm-hmm. All right, Robin, I want to thank you for a very, very powerful interview today. And I also want you to give people the way that they want to get in contact with Colibri. Give them the contact information for that.
Thank you so much. www.colibricenter.org. That's C-O-L. ibcenter.org, and you can donate there, support our work, or just send us a note and encourage us. We appreciate it very much.
All right, Robin Reinicke, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to talking to you
thank
again
you.
Soon. All right,
Thanks
take care
so
now. Bye.
You too. Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Robin Reinecke, co-founder and executive director of the Calibri Center for Human Rights. And we've been talking about family separation and death at the hands of the U.S. government and its Border Patrol. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with my conversation with Boots Riley about his brand new film, Sorry to Bother You. Pleased to be bringing you this segment of the show. It's a conversation I had the other day with Boots Riley. Boots is a rapper, producer, screenwriter, and director, and he joins us to talk about his recently released debut film, Sorry to Bother You, which is set in a present-day dystopian alternate version of Oakland, California. And I'm telling you, this film will just knock your socks off, right? It's a hilarious comedy with terrific acting, and as one reviewer observed, with enough social commentary to fill a dozen comedies. It examines the choices facing particularly black people today and the idea that you can make it, but only if you learn to ignore injustice and think only of yourself. And even then, you face betrayal. The main character in it is a character called Cassius Cash Green, and it's played by Lakeith Stanfield, and he's desperate for a job and becomes a telemarketer. As he succeeds, he's faced with decisions about the course of his own life and the fate of many others, okay? In fact, in a lot of ways, the fate of all humanity. So this is definitely something we want to jump into. Boots Riley, I can't see
hey,
you,
Mike.
Man. Hi, how you doing, man?
What's happening, man? All right.
You know, I've seen your film twice so far, and I keep telling everyone, go see this damn thing, man. Go see it. You congrats, man. You
cool.
did a really great job. And I remember just,
thank you.
You know, when you were talking about it originally, it was something that was just beginning to shape up, and I was just astounded by it when I saw it. So let's jump into it. It's a killer uh-huh. film. Congrats on that. But one question, why this film now?
Because I couldn't get it done earlier. I think I got to the end the first time in 2012, maybe even earlier, and, have been 3 months away from shooting for that long. So, you know, that's just how it goes, little by little. And, you know, the film has changed since then, and so it needed that, actually, because, you know, at that time it would go like a month, and I get this person to read it, and then a couple months later, that person will read it, then give me some notes, and then, you know, many things like that. Then we published it as its own paperback book, as part of McSweeney's Quarterly. I mean, in screenplay form, but as its own paperback book, and packaged it with the Quarterly, and then I got into the Sundance Screenwriters Lab. Then the year after that, into the Directors Lab. So there's just been all these little steps mm-hmm. to get it up there. And actually, although the film is relevant now, it also was relevant
yeah.
back then, because it's not the person in elected office that makes it relevant. It's the system that we're in, the economic system, capitalism, right. that makes it relevant.
Yeah, and that's important. That's what I was more like thinking about in terms of asking that question, because, you know, there's a thing here, like even in relation to your work. Look, you know, we've known each other a long time, and I've told you this before. Your work has always had a visual component in my mind, you know, because listening to your work, I could see yeah. the people that you were featuring in your music. And a whole
yeah.
section of people was brought to life in those beats, you know, the rhymes and beats. But, you know, in this film, taking off in a new direction, I'm really glad you moved to do what you did. But it's also, it's sort of, there's something there where you actually, the beauty of seeing, the power of seeing the people and actually seeing it. And then you're up against also knowing that it's a different kind of film because it has all that stuff in there, but it also has this element of something you haven't done before, which is horror. Let's talk about that. What led you there?
Well, that's something in the third act. I personally wouldn't put in the classification of horror, but I would like to not talk about that because I don't talk about that in you know, it's a spoiler.
Okay, believe me, I went over these questions with a fine-tooth comb not to do that. I was just more thinking
yeah.
about that. It's a different approach where it is and it isn't, because I really felt seeing the film, in the same way that I, when I listened to your music, I felt in the same way that I actually knew these people when I was watching them in the film. I knew who they were. I knew them. You could actually, you know, they were actually there in presence.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, so a couple things. One, I wanted to take the audience on a journey where things happened visually and viscerally in a way that made you feel similarly to the way Cassius was feeling at the time. And it made you feel like that feeling that you get when you come into new ideas that change your view on the world, or if you go through something that changes your view on the world, and the way the world looks changes, the way the world feels changes. And I didn't want us to just empathize with Cassius going through all those things. I wanted us to, be going through it with him. And so that informed a lot of the visual style. And it also informed the story. And one way that I was able to make, that I think I was able to make people accept all of these things happening is through the characters, as you said. And in order to make them more human, I wrote all of the characters, at least all the main characters, as myself. Like, I didn't say, oh, this person would say. Oh, that was in there. I just turned. It was like playing chess with myself. I'd say, oh, this is what I would say. With certain characters like Cassius, I had to, when he's making decisions or speaking, sometimes had to speak as if it was me. When I would say to myself, what would I say or do in this situation? Then, you know, the first thing that I answer, I'd have to be like, well, what is informing that with me? So I'd have to look into my own past and my own history and be like, okay, let's say if I had never gotten involved in a movement, the stuff that I believed then and maybe things that I would go through after, based on that other route, what would I say? So that was that. The characters in there really represent different aspects of me that are always battling with each other. So
now that's interesting.
The artist.
That's interesting because you have the great and mighty Oz in there, Steve Lift. That character.
Well, I mean, there's some aspects to that. I mean, you in the sense, and I would say that's probably the least one that I did that with. But just coming from the standpoint that everyone thinks they're doing the right thing. There's very few people that are like, even capitalists that are rubbing their hands together being like, I'm doing evil, I'm getting over, whatever. They are getting over, and they are objectively doing messed up things and evil, if you will. But they have a point of view that makes them think they're saving the world. So I wrote his character from that perspective.
Yeah, and I meant to mention that actually that Steve Lift is a mega capitalist in this film, and it's interesting because when you write it from that perspective and you're looking at that and you're looking at how he's actually falling out, it really does strike you that the immorality of capitalism is actually something that these guys don't consider. It's like this is, you know, to them it's all great, you know, and that's the thing that you captured in that character, which I thought was really, really good in terms of the conflict, you know, with the other characters in the film as well. So. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Boots Riley about his new film, Sorry to Bother You. And this film is it's a killer. It's funny as hell, it's serious, and it features really a great cast of people, including Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Armie Hammer, Danny Glover, and the voices of David Cross and Patton Oswalt. Don't miss this film, folks. It'll have you laughing, holding your breath, thinking and laughing again. It's just that damn good, all right? Tell me this, man. The character of Cassius Green, it begins, and this is, hopefully, again, I'm being careful not to try and reveal anything, you know, major here, but there's a level of things where a price has to be paid for almost every step you take, one way or the other, and in particular with this character. And I know you worked at a
call marketing.
Yeah, so yeah. And I worked at one, and I've never felt dirtier in my life. You know, it was sort of it was pretty bad. And but the basic thing here is that you've put this where there's this guy that's trying to make his way out of a big sort of flat nothing in his life, and he goes into this thing. He goes into this telemarketing thing, and it becomes sort of an escape for him. It becomes a way out of things. But there's a point where he has to make decisions. And let's talk about just sort of the complexity of that character for a minute.
Yeah, I think that, what I try to build him as is a piece that I think is part of what makes many of us human, or all of us. I think at most anyone that I've talked to goes through this, where and often characters aren't portrayed this way, much less usually black characters aren't portrayed this way, where people are thinking of themselves in the context of the world, in the context of the universe, in the context of time and space. And it's that existential question that no matter how revolutionary or capitalist you are, that idea is somewhere in your head. And for some of us, we get more obsessed with it than others. But I think that is a quality like of self-reflection that ends up being that is in many characters. I mean, many people that aren't necessarily reflected in characters that are written for the screen. And so I wanted to approach it from the standpoint that not only is he, does he have this sort of, not only is he trying to climb the ladder, but he's really trying to make himself feel engaged with the world, make himself feel useful or purposeful. And, you see this in people when they work for a big company. They might even just work for, they might even work at a shoe store, and they work for Nike or whatever at a shoe store, and they're really proud of the new thing that's coming out that Nike is about to put out, right? They get really, that's their way of feeling connected to the world, whatever they can grab onto. And so in this case, he's looking for a way to have more agency in his own world. First it's the job, then he discovers this white voice, not discovers, it gets taught to him by Danny Glover's character, and how to do a magic white voice where even to the people around him he sounds overdubbed, and the overdub for him is done by David Cross, and for Omari Hardwick's character is done by Patton Oswalt. Everything involves a decision. But for me, a big question is, what are the motivations behind the decision? Right. So even though he's choosing something and losing or winning a certain amount, what does he think he has to gain?
Mm-hmm. Now we have about... go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry. I talk long.
No, that's all right. That's all right, man. Believe me, I'm willing to listen as long as you're willing to talk, okay? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Boots Riley. Boots is long known as a really, really talented and moving hip-hop MC, and now he has moved into the film world, and he is the director and writer of a brand new film that's just sweeping across the country. And the name of the film is Sorry to Bother You. Let's talk about this because we have a limited amount of time, and I want to make sure we speak about this one too, because another character that you make a central part of this film that's just a remarkable character is Detroit, Tessa Thompson playing Detroit. And she plays an important role politically in the film that actually sometimes, you have to really listen to understand how important that role is in terms of the pole that she's establishing. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, like I wrote, Cassius is like the part of me that's the person looking to make their life to feel connected to, you know, everything. And matter of fact, all of these characters are, but her way of doing it is that part of me that's the artist. And of course, all these actors took it and took the character somewhere else. So that's just what it started at as part of me. But they took the character somewhere else, and we worked together to do that. And I think what she represents is this idea about art, like, and it's probably a conversation or debate that you and I have had a few times, and about what art can actually accomplish, and what is an artist's role in the world, and I think she's trying to answer those questions for herself. She's pretty sure about certain things. Mm-hmm. But she's trying to answer those questions. I think there's a conflict between, there's a conflict and an alliance between her and the union organizer, which is Squeeze. So I think that I think that Detroit, Tessa Thompson's character, really represents this idea and this about what artists can or should be doing, and what actually moves things, what actually changes things. Can we do it just through spectacle? Mm-hmm. And if it's not just through spectacle, at that point, what role does the artist have in everything that we think needs to be changed? Mm-hmm. I think there are some people who watch the movie and maybe just look at her as the artsy girlfriend, but definitely she is not that at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, real quick on this, because, and I know you're not going to get into this very deeply at all, but this whole thing that runs through here is actually sort of a system that, while it claims all the beauties and freedoms and all this other stuff, actually has a component, a very serious component of slavery that it relies on. And you do that really well in the film in terms of bringing that out as the motivation for the big capitalists that are out there doing this. But it exists almost in a world of its own. And I think that's really important in terms of the equation of this kind of slavery that people are living in all over the world. And,
yeah,
you know, go ahead.
The only exaggeration in the movie is that it's happening in the United States. Mm-hmm. In that exact way. And so it's not very far off from everything going on now. The matter of fact, in the 2014 version that came out on McSweeney's, Omari Hardwick's character, which is just Mr., which is Mr. with 7 underscores, mm-hmm. His character had the line, "Worry-free is making America great again."
Okay.
I had to take it out because the world had made my script too on the nose.
All right. On that note, Boots, thank you very much for a great film, man. And I really encourage people
to
see it.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking to me.
Sure. And hey, listen, real quick, man.
Oh, yeah. And we got the new Coup album, which is the soundtrack to this movie, which is confusingly called Sorry to Bother You, the soundtrack.
Okay.
Will be out in a few days.
All right, I was just going to ask you about
that. The single will be out today.
Great. All right, I was going to ask you about that. And, you know, I have to tell you, man, it's really good. Really a remarkable film.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks so much. All right.
All right, man.
Hi.
Take care.
Peace.
Bye. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. That was the Douglas Street Shuffle by Maracatu New York, and tell me that's something that you just can't stop listening to. Now we're going to hear an interview I did recently with Reverend Frank Wolf and Ramona Tolliver, members of the Faith Task Force of Refuse Fascism. We talked about the use of religion by the Trump-Pence regime to justify increasingly horrible fascist measures and the importance of people of faith in particular to stand up and say no. The interview took place prior to Refuse Fascism's National Faith Weekend. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. Frank Wolf is pastor of Echo Park United Methodist Church and a member of the Faith Task Force of Refuse Fascism. And Ramona Tolliver is of the Faith Task Force of Refuse Fascism. Frank, Ramona, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're coming together to talk about a lot of things right now, but I want to, in particular, there's a lot to talk about. Frank, let's start with you. What are you talking about here? What's going on here?
What's going on here is that, you know, faith has played a major role in the political politics in the United States. It's done this for years, and as often as not, faith has been used in many cases to justify just absolutely abhorrent policies. And one of the most recent of those, of course, is separation of children from their parents, and then subsequently the incarceration of families together, and the whole mess around the no-tolerance policy of the Trump administration. Faith has been used as a tool to justify these kinds of abhorrent policies over the years, and we are feeling a really important need for those of us who are part of the faith community who do not believe in these kinds of policies and who believe in justice and who believe in the kind of world where everyone can live safely and fairly and justly together, that we need to start speaking up. We can't just simply remain silent and allow the kinds of policies that we're seeing done in the name of faith to continue to be done. We've got to stand up and say no as much as anyone else has to stand up and say no. And we've seen times in the past where the religious community has remained silent, where fascist forces begin to rise to power. That's what happened in Germany in the 1930s, and we've seen it in Italy and at that same time, and we've seen it in other places around the world where the church has maybe not said yes to fascism, but it has also not said no. And so because of its failure to stand up and make a clear no, it is in some ways made itself very complicit. And so we're saying we've got to be part of helping the faith community to find its voice, to say no, that there cannot be a fascist America, and that we're going to join in the struggle to make sure that the Trump-Pence regime must go. And we have to do it because we are called by our faith to love our brothers and our sisters as we love ourselves. And we can't do that and allow the kinds of things that are happening in the name of the Trump-Pence regime to continue. And so we're having this event to help bring the religious community together around that and to talk very seriously with one another about how we as a faith community can become involved in the struggle to bring an end to this fascist regime and to say no at this time.
Okay. Ramona, what about you? What brought you into this and what's the importance of this?
You know, I got involved in this because I grew up in the South, in Virginia, child of the Civil Rights Movement. And as a child, I saw the role that the religious community played in so many, righting so many wrongs back then. And I kind of actually stayed on the outskirts of becoming politically involved in any way during my adult life. But when we got to the point where I was listening day after day about the atrocities against the Muslims and against the LGBTQ community and against women, it was like, wait a minute, perhaps I should join in with the people who are taking a stand. And coming from a faith background, my father was a Baptist minister, and having seen what went on in the church, it was like, let me approach this from a point that's meaningful to me. Uh-huh. And so when I met Frank and some other religious leaders, and I said, there is power in numbers, and we don't want to go along any longer in the religious community with the silence means consent perspective, because actually if you don't speak up, you are giving consent to what has happened. And I just felt like the time is now to try, not just within my religious community, but to take action to pull all of the different religious communities together, because there is strength in number. And so as part of the group, our idea was, let's have events that would allow the different groups to come together to explain things from their perspective and to figure out what we can do. Because we don't need hundreds of people, we need millions of people to stop the wrongs that are being done under this administration.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that's happening, and Frank, I would ask you this first, one of the things that's happening here in this country is that religion is really being cited by and used as a cover by some of the most heinous people ever in the history of the country. You have Jeff Sessions, you know, talking about biblical scriptures being used to justify their deviant behavior and twisted beliefs. Let's talk about that, because that's actually something I think a lot of people are looking at. And there's sort of like, there's on the one hand, people can see people beginning to come together, see various people of faith coming together, whether they're ministers, priests, whatever, coming together. And then at the same time, you see somebody like Sessions and Trump, you know, all of these people who actually are upholding and actually mobilizing a vast, basically, you know, Christian fascist organization in the country. So let's talk about that a little.
Well, you know, Jeff Sessions and I actually share a religious tradition. He's United Methodist, just as I am. And I don't say that with a great deal of pride, obviously. But, you know, Jeff Sessions cited the 13th chapter of Paul's letter to the Romans as a place that calls for us to obey the laws and to obey the powers. And, you know, it's amazing when you stop and think about it, that for those of us who call ourselves Christians, and not all of us in the Faith Task Force do, but for those of us who do, we follow Jesus, who is actually convicted, tortured, and executed as a criminal because of what was perceived to be opposition to the status quo and opposition to the state, opposition to the laws of the land and the powers at that particular time. And so we, you know, at the very core, at the very heart of our faith is resistance to the tyranny of the powers that be, in particular to the Roman Empire at that time. And I would say that resistance continues up to the present day. Now, the people like Jeff Sessions, who are in power at the moment, and who are calling for us to give in to the call to follow wherever the Trump administration leads and to embrace whatever religious kinds of interpretations it brings, they've got something to gain to accomplish their goal in citing scripture in a particular way. But I think we have to be clear, we have to be faithful to our faith traditions, which are not primarily calling us to simply bow down and to give in to the call to fascism, that are not calling us to violate the fundamental principles of our faith. And all religions have similar fundamental principles. And the fundamental principles being, you know, to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. That's key. You see that again and again and again. If you read even deeper within the scriptures of the Christian tradition, the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, which is also Jewish tradition, says that we should love the immigrant as we love ourselves, because we too were immigrants at one particular time, and that we should treat them as citizens. And so there is an alternative, a competing narrative within the scriptures, one that calls us to stand up for right over against what is wrong, even when what is right is not popular, even when it's not part of what those in power are wanting us to do, and to be willing to suffer the consequences of standing up and opposing the unjust policies of governments like the Trump-Pence administration. So that second narrative is not a narrative that is well known at this present time in history. We tend to hear the fundamentalists, the Franklin Grahams, these kinds of folks who are telling us that the scripture means one thing, and it's closing down any real thinking about what the scriptures really say. And as a consequence, it's forcing us into the belief that to be a true Christian, to be a true Jew, to be a true whatever, that we have to follow where this government is leading us. I don't think that's a real interpretation of Scripture, and we have to engage that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Ramona, can you tell us a little bit about, now Frank's been talking about that, we've been talking about this in general for a while, can you give me some idea of what people can expect? People coming together to do what, and what can people expect to find there?
There will be leaders from different denominations present to make an appeal or to discuss how they are dealing in their own congregations or communities with the attempts to fight this fascist regime that is going on, what they're trying to do to bring their people together. And there will be some entertainment, dance and song.
Okay. Frank, we have just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you this. Why you think, give your hardest argument for why people should be there. There's going to be a clip both to the clergy that you might be listening to the show and be moved to come, but also broadly to the people themselves coming in and taking this up. Give that argument.
Anyway, why should they come? They should come because not coming is to acquiesce to what this administration is doing. It's to become complicit in the acts of injustice that this administration is involved in. And it is acquiescing to the idea that somehow our faith traditions are calling us not to stand up for justice and for what is right, but rather to give in to the powers that be. So why should you come? You should come because we need to make our faith, our voices known. We need to, the faith community needs to be involved, because this is a nation that still is very much a nation that depends upon faith. And so we have to be able to speak to the issues of faith that touch people's hearts and to let people know that there's a different way of understanding, a different way of behaving in response to faith than what we are told so often by this administration and by others.
Okay. Frank Wolf, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay. And Ramona Tolliver, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure because I am my brother's keeper.
Okay.
Amen.
And I'm really glad both of you were able to make it. So I'll talk to you again soon. Okay. Take care now.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Now.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Reverend Frank Wolf, pastor of Echo Park United Methodist Church and member of the Faith Task Force of Refuse Fascism, and Ramona Tolliver of the Faith Task Force of Refuse Fascism. We've got some time left, so I want to play a clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, this was taken from a recent talk that Avakian gave. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. And this clip is the Christian fascists now in power. And I think you'll agree, it goes with the conversation I just had about saying no to the fascists.
Perhaps it seems harsh or even extreme to refer to these fundamentalist Christians as fascists. Well, in Catherine Stewart's book, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on Americans' Children, she cites these comments by Rich Lang, himself a former Christian fundamentalist who broke with that and became a liberal Christian pastor. When I was born again, Lang recalls, faith was something inside of you, something you were supposed to reflect through your life. But in the 1980s, something happened. Fundamentalist Christianity jumped back into the public square with the intention to reshape the country as a Christian nation as defined by them. It's no different than the Nazis wanting to start with the Hitler Youth. That is where you'd want to start if you were trying to build a fascist movement. That's the word, fascism. Nobody likes to use it in this country. But I believe that in this country, underneath the appearances, that is exactly the great temptation of our time. And you have to call it what it is, Christian fascism. Stewart further summarizes Lang's views this way. Modern fundamentalism, like fascism in earlier times, he says, involves a strong feeling of persecution, typically at the hands of godless liberals or a religious other. The belief that one belongs to a pure race or national group that is responsible for past greatness, suffers unjust oppression in the present, and is the rightful ruler of the world. The impulse to submit unquestioningly to absolute authority, and the relentless drive for power and control. It is, he says, a kind of supremacist movement with religion rather than race at its core. And there is this chilling statement by Lang. People have no idea it's going on. What does it mean that the conservative church that's growing in America is an end times church? What does it mean that we are raising a generation of children to believe that they are the last generation? What is going to happen if we keep on telling them, don't care about the environment and bring on the war because we're going to be lifted out of here? And you can forget about loving your neighbors because they're just going to get blown away. So that is the insight of someone very familiar with these Christian fascists. And the fact is that in this country, with its whole history of genocide, slavery, and racism, any form of fascism, including one basing itself on Christian supremacy, any urge to restore past greatness cannot help but be bound together with white supremacy.
All right, that was Bob Avakian. That was a clip taken from a talk that Avakian gave called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." And this clip, along with many others, is available on the site revcom.us. All right, I want to thank everybody that worked on the show today, and we're going to rush through this because we have a special present for you. I want to thank Henry Carson, my assistant producer. I want to thank Jeff Pryor, my production assistant. I want to thank Teddy Robinson for, I guess I'm going to thank him for a very long time now for being our board up for today. And each and every one of you for tuning in. You want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a special sort of gift for you and plugging into what people are doing around the world. A little over a week ago, a campaign was begun on social media in the UK to make Green Day's song American Idiot number one on the charts today, July 13th, the day that Trump was scheduled to visit England. Beginning July 6th, thousands bought the single online, streamed it on services like Spotify, and watched the YouTube, which itself now has 116 million views. In London, the streets were filled with protesters against the fascist Trump. The results for American Idiot, the song, were announced on Twitter. Amazon, number one. Google Play, number one. iTunes, number three. So now we're going to join with the anti-fascists everywhere. Here's American Idiot by Green Day. Talk to you again next week.